This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Experiencing a void in her life and responding to what she believed was a calling from God, Mary Clark, a divorced mother of seven, left her suburban home in Beverly Hills, put on a nun's habit, and moved into La Mesa State Penitentiary, one of the roughest prisons in Latin America. Ever since then, she's been known as Mother Antonia and has devoted her life to helping the inmates. Her work has ranged from providing aspirin to stopping a prison riot. At a prison mass celebrating her 25th year of living in La Mesa, she was given a standing ovation from hundreds of robbers, drug traffickers, and murderers. During one of her recent trips out of the prison, she spoke to us from a studio in California. Mother Antonia, who is now approaching 80, is the subject of a new book called The Prison Angel by the Washington Post reporters Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan. They found her while writing their Pulitzer Prize-winning series of articles on Mexico's criminal justice system. They describe Mother Antonia as one of Rome's most unconventional servants. Mother Antonia, why, after two divorces and seven children, when you were in your early 50s, did you decide to start a new life by becoming a nun and moving into a prison?
Terry, I think that's a question everybody would like to know, and one that's very hard to answer in the sense that I was 50, and it wasn't I decided to start a new life, because for many years I had interest in the mission fields, and I particular love for Mexico, and I had visited many times the penitentiary in Tijuana, and it became a part of my life in a certain way. And in reflection, for about 2 years of a very long retreat, you might say, in reflection on my life, I knew that I wanted my life, that God called me. And a call from God is not something, it's the same as when you fall in love. You can't exactly describe why you're in love or what day you fell in love or how it was. But a time came when I knew that it was time for me to go and a step, you know, to become a being with, and not just observing and being aware of, but being with those people that in particular way I was called to serve. And that was Christ in the prisoner, that I felt our Lord was a prisoner, and I felt very called to serve that Lord that was in prison, hated very often, and away from his family, and many sometimes innocent, and almost always poor. And so it was a call that came to me. It actually started many years ago in a dream, but I don't know if you'd want me to tell that. But it was a very, would you like to hear it?
Sure.
Well, it was many years ago, but many years before I went to the prison, and I had a dream. It was a strange dream. And I dreamt I was at Calvary, but I didn't know who I was, because I was in the dress of that time. And a Roman guard came to me and told me I was going to be crucified, and I was horrified. I didn't know at that moment Jesus or the crucifixion or anything. I knew crucifixion was horrible. And I asked why. And there were many people there, and each one turned away when I asked why. And then I prayed that God would take me, because I was so afraid of being crucified. And a guard came back to me, a Roman guard, and told me, you don't have to pray. There's a man, and he wants to take your place. And I turned and looked into what was a cart. Maybe that comes from what I've read of French revolutionaries, executions being taken away, the people in carts. But I saw this man standing there in a white robe, and he just looked at me. And he did not look at me as if I owed him something. He did not look at me as if, look what I'm doing for you. He wants to take your place, as if he was giving without asking anything back in return. And I turned away from him, and I said, he's a man, and he's very brave, and he's willing. He's willing. And the guard came back and said, he wants you to stand by him. And I said, I can't. I can't stand violence. I couldn't stand by a man being crucified. He said, woman, he's there in your place. And so I looked back, and there was my Lord stretched out on the wood, but not nailed down to it. And I suddenly loved more than I feared. And I ran behind him and knelt down on the ground and took his face in my hands, but he didn't have a face any longer. It was blank where a face should be. and only his hair was coming down each side, his hands were stretched out, and I said, in my hands, I'll hold your face. And I thought, I'm afraid, but I'm more afraid to leave him now. I wouldn't leave him. I said, I'm not going to leave you. I'm never going to leave you, no matter what they do to me. And I stood, waited for the blow of the hammer, and I woke up. Over the years in prison, I realized sometimes in the infirmary in particular, when I first started and there was more violence than there is now, and I would go into the infirmary, a man had been stabbed, and he was lying on the table, his hands were stretched out. And I would stand behind the doctors and the police or guards that were questioning him who did this and what happened, and I would hold his face. And I would say, look, Lord, I'm with you again. And he would say, always, no te vayas, no te vayas, don't go, don't go, don't leave me. And I would tell him, I'm not going to leave you. I'm never going to leave you. Well, that's a little background. That was the beginning of a very strong call.
You know, although you felt you were called and you knew the work you wanted to do, and you knew you wanted to be a nun, you applied to several orders, but judging from the book, it sounds like the church basically told you, you're too old, it's too late, you can't be a nun.
Well, it's not quite true today. They take women older today, a little older. But I was 50, and the age limit was 35. I particularly loved the Marinal sisters and their work. And I called, and they loved me too, but I was beyond 15 years beyond the age limit. And it wasn't for me. And I knew that if Mary Noel would not accept me, that knew me and loved me, that there wouldn't be any other order either that would accept me at that age. Perhaps a contemplative order. And I might state something to you, if you'll allow me, Terry. You said, I knew I wanted to be a nun. They'll always refer to me and other sisters as nuns. Actually, nuns are women who live in cloister in monasteries. The Carmelites are nuns. The Benedictines are nuns. The rest of us are called sisters because we're active the Carmelites and Benedictines are in their great prayer life that for all of us and you and everyone in the world, and their works they do for the poor, but they are they're monastic orders. And so if you notice, they're called the Sisters of Our Lady of Charity, the Sisters of this or that. I just wanted you to know because I thought you might be interested.
Oh, absolutely, and I appreciate that clarification. So I should say then that you knew you wanted to be a sister and you weren't able to actually join an order in that capacity because you were too old. So what you ended up doing was becoming almost like a freelance sister? You put
yes,
on a habit?
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
That's a very good way to put it, Terry. A very good way. But I was a freelance sister, but I had the same boss that the other sisters did. So I was pretty sure of that, and I was certain that if I didn't, I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing.
So you put on a habit, you went to the prison in Tijuana, where you had been doing some work already.
Yes.
And you wanted to move in there so that you could literally be with the prisoners, live with the prisoners.
Yes, be with.
What did you have to do to get permission from the authorities to do that? I mean,
well,
really,
I was
they
in
must
Mexico
have thought
with
you
with the wonderful uh-huh. Mexican people.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mexican authorities and the Mexican people they have that great gift of flexibility. Everything isn't just... You know, I don't think I could have done that at San Quentin, honestly, because many people ask me, why didn't you go to San Quentin? Why didn't you go, you know, to one of our prisons? Well, I don't really think I could knock on the door and say, could I live in here and serve the people in here? I don't believe I could. La Mesa at that time was different than it is now. I probably couldn't do it at La Mesa prison now because it's become very Americanized.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mother Antonia. About 30 years ago, when she was about 50, she felt that she was called to give her life to Jesus Christ and the poor. She moved into a cell in a prison in Tijuana and has basically lived there ever since, working with and on behalf of the prisoners. Now there's a new book about her that's called The Prison Angel. Would you describe what the conditions were like at La Mesa State Penitentiary in Tijuana when you first got there about 30 years ago?
Well, to me, You know, there's various opinions of what the conditions were like. For me, I was overjoyed that I could be in a mission, the mission of, that God called me to. And the conditions were harsh in a certain way. We were poor. And it was very, very flexible. And families moved in sometimes. And the nice thing was all babies were allowed to stay with their mothers, because a baby doesn't know if it's in a crib in a royal palace or it's on a bunk in a prison. It only knows the love of the mother. And now we're not allowed to keep babies because we haven't got a place to keep them. We may be able to one day, I hope, because that was one of the beautiful parts, the parts that were difficult. In those days, it was certain that it wasn't, there was more drugs and corruption, and it wasn't as the, I don't think the conditions were nearly as good as they are today.
What about routine torture and violence?
Well, they speak of routine torture, and it's very hard for me to speak of anything like that, because I have to say that I'm very loyal to the people that have been so good to me. Yes, there was torture. I can't say there was not. I can't say, I think I was very, that my presence was a very positive presence, that I was a instrument of peace in this war zone. Because in wherever there's torture and there's hate, and so it was a war zone in that sense. And I think that I could do something about it. I could stop it. Never was anyone tortured in my presence.
Did you try to talk the prison authorities out of that kind of behavior? Or?
Oh, yes, I did.
Tell us more about what you did to intervene.
Well, you'd be surprised.
Try me.
Oh, my poor comandante. I remember what I had, and I once in a while get to see him now, and he was very, very young. And I'd heard about men being beaten, and I went to the director and told the director and the sub-director, and I went to the cell and got this one man out of the cell and brought him into the infirmary, because I said, look at his body is marked. Well, the guards were in so much trouble they almost lost their jobs, and the comandante was very angry with me. And I said, I'm sorry, I said, but I serve Christ first. And he said, I served the vigilantes here. Three men almost lost their jobs today. Why didn't you come to me? But then I said, just give me another chance. Don't let me continue to go there. Let me continue to serve. Let me, just don't stop me any place. And he said, he accepted that. He just motioned me away, but with the promise I'd never again tell on them. And of course I did again. And so the second time was just too much for him. And he didn't talk to me after that. And so finally, I'd say to him, Comandante, do you love me? And he would say, no. And then Comandante, just once in a while. Then I started to bring him a rose. And he didn't want to accept it. And I said, it's from St. Teresa. And so there isn't any good Mexican that wouldn't accept a rose from St. Teresa. And so he took the rose. But he didn't talk to me. So finally I got one of these little hand dolls. I forget what they call them. Kermit, a little frog that came on.
Oh, from Sesame Street? Uh-huh.
That's right. And it was a hand puppet. And I opened the door to his office, and I cried out, Comandante, Comandante. And I was pretending to cry. El Comandante no me quieres. El Comandante no me quieres. Oh, oh, oh. And I was saying that he doesn't love me. And he started to laugh. And he said, I said, do you love me? He said, you know the answer to that. And then we became very good friends. Nobody, Terry, in my experience, can resist being prayed for and loved.
In this book, the writers describe a prison riot in which you intervened and you basically got the men to disarm. Would you tell us what the riot was about and what your response to it was?
Well, I don't do anything without praying. And people say she went in alone. Well, it depends on what you believe. If you believe the way I do, I never believed I was alone. I always called on St. Michael, and I probably had a battalion of angels with me. And I think the one that they're probably talking about in the book is where there were shots being fired And I walked in, and I asked the director, Licenciado Jorge Duarte, who was killed, unfortunately. He was a great man. Let me go in. That's my mission. If you stop me now, you're stopping me on my mission, because I must be with those men. If I wasn't there with them in this moment of crisis, then what kind of a servant am I really? A frightened one, an unfaithful one. And so I did go in, and I walked up the stair. The men came out from, I don't know where, they all made a circle around me. I couldn't even walk because they circled me and said, Mother, what are you doing here? And they shouted out, Don't shoot, Mother's here. And they said, Mother, and I told them outside, people are praying for you. They're crying. Your mothers are saying rosaries, your girlfriends and your wives, your children are all frightened. And what's going on here? When they saw me and heard me, I said, The guns, give me the weapons right now, sons. Give them to me. God is watching. God is with us. And we're going to help you. You are right to be upset. You have every right to feel upset. And I'm sorry. I didn't visit you to see that you had needs. But we can take care of those things. But in the meantime, give me the guns. And I promise you, you won't be punished. I promise. And they said, Mother, when we knew it was you, we dropped the guns out the cell. There was a window alongside these cells with bars, too. But they took the guns and dropped them down to the ground. And so that all the television cameras were there and the newsreels and this radio and from Mexico City and from San Diego. And they were marveling. Really, they were marveling that, and saying I was the one that stopped the riot. I would say that love stopped it, caring about them, talking to them like they were human beings, giving them the dignity that everybody needs. Give me a chance. Accept my apology. Accept the apology of the authorities. Give us a chance to treat you better. Please, give us that chance. That's all they needed.
You promised these prisoners that if they dropped their guns, that they wouldn't be punished, that you'd make sure
That's
they wouldn't
right.
be punished. Were you were you able to deliver on that promise?
Yes.
Were you able to convince the convince the authorities not to punish the men who?
Because I'm talking with Mexican authorities, and they understand when they have men that are armed, and they don't want to come in against them because they don't want to shoot anybody, they don't want to kill anybody, just the way our police don't want to. They don't want a violent problem involving maybe 30, 50, 300. It would build up that. If they had to make the promise that they'd be treated better, that they'd be reconsidered why they were in the cells, that they'd maybe be sent back to their own cells, that they'd improve the conditions in the cells of punishment, that was a promise that they should keep because it was the righteous thing to do. So I was certain when I presented it to the officials in that way that they would accept it, and they did.
You came from, an upper-middle-class background?
Yes.
You grew up in a prosperous suburb. Where you're living now within the prison, are there rats? Does it smell? Is it clean?
Well, there are rats, of course. There are many, many men there. It's kept clean. Yes, it's kept very clean. Today, it is kept very clean. There are people cleaning all the time. It's kept clean. It's kept clean. There's huge bins for garbage, and the food is served on trays today with men that wear prisoners that wear gloves and have hats, and they have cubrebocas over their head. I'm not uncomfortable. I'm accustomed to cold water, and it doesn't bother me. In fact, it's very refreshing to me. And I have a bathroom. I have windows to look out of. I have kittens outside my door. And I have a little bodega, which I keep where I keep the things I bring in to give out to the people. I'm never alone because I'm always with the Lord and with the guards. I love the guards, too. I might mention that. And I serve them, too. They're a very important part of my work, and the police are, too.
I'm assuming that there are prisoners in La Mesa, in Tijuana, where you live, who have tried to take advantage of you, who have tried to steal from you, who have said nasty things about you, who have tried to undermine your work. And when that has happened, as I assume it has, What have you done in response to it? Because sometimes that's just a way of testing you to see, she's so compassionate. What's she going to do after I steal from her? Let's see.
Yes, well, things like that have happened occasionally. However, they've been very occasionally. However, I don't, I have a very selective mind. And maybe you notice this on this tape. I don't select to remember and take heart to anybody what they say against me. And once again, I have a model. Jesus Christ did not defend himself. If my work does not defend me, Terry, I have no defense. That's how I feel. I thought my work itself, which by the fruits you know the tree, and when you're there with a woman when she's having a baby, and you're helping somebody that's been hurt, and you're the bandage for somebody else, or an antibiotic that somebody needs, you don't get it to gain their attention or gain their love or gain their... You do it because it's the right thing to do.
I assume that, you know, most or at least many of the prisoners who you are serving in Tijuana are guilty, that they're there because they're actually guilty, and guilty of murder or rape or robbery. And a lot of people might be wondering, why do you feel called to help them as opposed to helping the people who they victimized?
Well, I'm not opposed to helping the victims either. I certainly do whenever I can. And I help to explain to prisoners, to men in prison, that I call my sons. And I'd like to state this clearer. The majority of people in prison are not in prison for rape or murder or kidnapping or trafficking drugs. The majority of people there are for robo simple. They're for robbery, but not armed robbery, not bank robbery. And the root of the problem is really, whether people want to see it or not, is poverty and ignorance. Those are the two things that breed crime. And this has been proven in every single city in the world. Prejudice and ignorance and poverty, three things, breed crime wherever, in every city. However, to help them is to bring down the crime rate too. When they realize person after person has come to me that's changed their lives because I'm there, I always bring up the victims every single solitary day.
You've started a new order, and it's an order specifically for older women. And I'm really fascinated by this because, you know, as we were discussing, at the age of 50, when you wanted to become a sister, you couldn't because you were considered too old. And you've said that you think that, you know, you understand why younger women might not want to become sisters, but you understand why older women might be much more inclined to. And could you talk a little bit about why you wanted your order to be specifically for older women? What is it about older women that you think might be... you think that their lives might be more open to serving?
Well, I don't... What I felt, Terry, is that the gift, the call that a woman at 50 did go and did serve, and there was fruit on the tree there, that there are other women out there at 50 years old that have meaning, and they've been through many things in life. They've been through almost all the experience of life, life and death, success and failure. They've been to the top of the mountain, the depths of the valley, and they have all those experiences to give to people that are crying out for understanding and kindness and mercy and compassion. And that's what I believe I had to offer to women and to men one day, and even to those who have failed. And maybe in the darkness you see the stars, and that's when, by the time you're 50, you've had experiences that have been devastating in your life if you've lived it all in the world, and you've come to new understandings, as sorrow brings you into understandings that pleasure does not. And so you're not bitter, and if you are, you shouldn't be, because there's a world out there that needs you. You don't have to necessarily be a sister, a servant of the 11th Hour of St. John Hughes. You could go with some kind of Peace Corps or one of the many organizations that help people locally and worldwide. That there's so many people that need a visit, that need a hand, just a hand to hold their hand, just a look, in their eyes and understand something of what they're going through, just to show them a kindness.
Mother Antonia, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm very happy. I hope it was worthwhile, Terry.
Mother Antonia is the subject of the new book, The Prison Angel. It's written by the Washington Post reporters Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan, who won a Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on Mexico's criminal justice system.